Today, what a fine pickle we're in. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Roger Brown. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Martin. Good to see you.
Great to have you back on the show again. And you and I have been comparing notes over recent weeks with regards to rising interest rates, pressure on the banks and all of those things. And I thought it was a really good time to have another conversation. We are in a pickle, aren't we, with rates going up, with the debt that we've got here and the future trajectory and stress on the banks as well. So wherever you look, there's a problem.
Yeah, exactly. And everyone's trying to avoid facing the fact that it's a mess that seems to be difficult to solve. And I think one of the main reasons has been the ineffectiveness of APRA in the last 20 years. I've been saying that, as you know, on Twitter for quite some time. What they haven't done is anticipate where things were going. They didn't put a hold on the RBA's insane reductions of interest rates, particularly 2 years ago with the COVID matter. And now we are in a real problem, because interest rates are going up. Whereas the RBA thought they would ever stay down. In fact, 0.01 until 2024.
Well, let's start with that for a bit, because Wayne Byres is now leaving earlier than expected. He was reappointed under Frydenberg without much ado, although I was a bit surprised. And of course, his background is connected with the Bank for International Settlements and all of those things.
Yes.
But I have the view that APRA has absolutely been asleep at the wheel for many, many years, and in fact are on the side of the banks rather than the side of financial stability, believe it or not.
Yeah, exactly. And I just happened to look up Wayne Byres' previous history. He was appointed in 2014. To APRA. Before that, he was 10 years at the RBA. And before then, he worked for the Bank of England. And between 2011 and 2014, he was Secretary General of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. So effectively, they put the fox in charge of the chicken hutch because he's a banker. He's a banker. So he'll listen to the banks, he'll do their bidding. He's not actually looking at it from a consumer point of view, and he certainly isn't looking at it from a point of view of indebted borrowers of mortgage finance. And there lies the problem. You'll remember, Martin, in 2014, when it must have been Hockey, I guess, who jumped in and instructed APRA to tighten up on interest-only lending. And they did so. And, of course, we've been saying, I know you'd been saying, I've been saying, that one of the reasons for the doubling in house prices in Australia was interest-only mortgages. And the boffins couldn't quite understand it because they've got such a long alphabetical tail, they can't get off the ground. They didn't realise that when it's interest only, you've got twice as much money to incur a debt with. In other words, mortgages used to be on the basis of principal repayments and interest. So if it's a 30-year loan, roughly speaking, your principal repayments are 3% per year for that 30 years, plus your interest rates. So when interest only came in to purchase homes for so-called investment purposes originally, if a person had $20,000 to spare, instead of incurring a mortgage of, say, $400,000, they could go to $700,000, $750,000, $800,000. So that's what happened. So APRA then instructed banks to tighten up on interest-only loans. And you'll remember that within 15 or 18 months, house prices dropped. From memory, it was 8%, something like that. It was quite substantial. And everyone got jittery. The real estate industry certainly spoke to the government. The government had their consultations with the banks, and everyone thought, this is a problem. We're getting mortgages now carried out properly. So I think it was 2019, Martin, you might recall, when Frydenberg jumped in and said, okay, it's time, this is to APRA, it's time that the banks eased up and solved this problem so that we do not keep affecting the price of housing. In other words, it's going down. This is no good. They didn't think of the young people under the age of 40 who were wanting to buy a house to raise a family in. They weren't interested in doubling the price of a house that they bought as an investment. And so you had this clash, which is the problem in Australia today. You have the people who want a home because they are building a family, creating a family, and those who have benefited by the outrageously increasing house prices to leverage into investment, so-called. Now, APRA should have stopped this happening. They should have just told the banks to change the way that they marketed mortgage finance.
Yeah, and of course that was the time when they also took the buffer down, right? Because previously there was a floor below which they couldn't lend, and then they changed it to a percentage above the market rate, as it were, which gave more capacity for banks to lend more. So yep. Into this environment, rather than actually leaning against the wind, they were actually leaning into encouraging it, right?
Yeah. And so they're now wondering why we have this problem. You know, as well as I do, that house prices have to drop by around 40% a minimum in the next 2 to 3 years to get back to their trend line. House prices for 70 years used to go up on an average of 2.5% to 3% per annum on the basis of that is the CPI, increased costs of labour, materials, etc. Well, now we've had 400% increase in house prices in 20 years. And no one, the boffins at the RBA and the regulators, so-called APRA, have not said, hold on, this means it's averaging 18% or something like that per annum, which is 5 to 6 times what it should be. So this is going to end in a catastrophe. No one has said that. But the price has to drop. House prices have to drop. And you're going to get bankruptcies now because in the last 2 years, the money was thrown around to the extent that house prices officially went up by 28%, I think it was, Martin, for 18 months. You'd know that figure. Now, that is huge, huge, huge. Mm-hmm. Now, someone has incurred those debts. They tend to be first home buyers. They tend to be people under the age of 40. And these are the people who will be the most affected when the downturn in prices occur.
Yeah, and there's a couple of points to make there. Of course, the bank's ratio of lending to business relative to mortgages has completely reversed in the last 20 years. It used to be 2/3 to business, 1/3 to consumers. Now it's 2/3 to consumers for mortgages, 1/3 to business. So the net effect of all of this is that you've got households massively indebted with overinflated house prices, people trying to chase their tail to get into the market. And you've got lending for business actually going backwards. It's very, very hard for a lot of small businesses to get any sort of funding at all. Or if they do, they've got to provide security by way of property. So essentially, this policy has completely messed up our economy. It's made the base of the economy narrower. It's made it much more risky because it's much more leveraged into property through construction as well as through mortgage lending. And nobody wants to take responsibility. I mean, it's interesting. APRA says they have no accountability or responsibility for house prices. They don't even consider it. And interestingly, APRA doesn't look at household debt exposure at the household level. They look at it at the loan level. So if you've got multiple loans with multiple entities, they don't see the complete picture. So they are steering the ship through the wrong lens, with the wrong data point, with the wrong outcomes. And yet they claim that they're actually guardians of financial stability. So how does that work?
Yeah, exactly. I came across something the other day. I'm just looking at it here, Martin. It was an analysis of the APRA Act of 1998 by a group of lawyers. I think they call themselves Law Point, something like that. And they said the following in their analysis. In performing and exercising its functions and powers, APRA is to balance the objectives of financial safety and efficiency, competition, contestability, and competitive neutrality. And in balancing these objectives is to promote financial system stability in Australia. Now, clearly, they've done none of that, because we have financial instability in Australia right now, which is because they did not carry out the objectives that they had or have.
Now, that's exactly right. And interesting, of course, because the APRA Act is meant to, be, if you like, their agenda setting momentum. Of course, it is actually determined a little bit by what the government wants, right? And you mentioned earlier on about the government, you know, essentially encouraging APRA to loosen the screws. And of course, Frydenberg tried to remove the responsible lending obligations from the banks completely encourage more people. And of course, it was all dressed up as a post-COVID economic booster. And that's the problem, right? Because effectively, the Treasury, I think, has been calling the shots here, insofar that economic momentum and growth has been completely anchored into growth in the housing market because of the way that we define growth. It's through GDP and, of course, activity in housing stokes GDP. But the consequences and risks are the problem now. Now, let's just turn the conversation slightly. RBA, right? The RBA, of course, took rates way too low and then didn't react soon enough when the COVID thing started to actually dissipate early. So, and then last November, of course, Phil Lowe said, well, rates aren't going to move up until 2024. So question, do you think people actually might have believed him at that point and made decisions based on what he said?
Well, it appears they did. A fair segment of the younger people thought, okay, we've been given 3 years clear run. We can't get into trouble for 3 years, and prices will have gone up, so we'll be saved with equity and all that sort of stuff. But the overriding thing, Martin, is that house prices in Australia have always been a political weapon.
Yep.
And if you look back to 2019, when it looked like the LNP were going to lose office to the ALP, with 3 weeks to go, and I think they were 2 points behind, with 3 weeks to go, Morrison jumped out of the starting blocks with the 5% deposit guarantee for new home buyers. And subsequent to the election, whilst the negative gearing factor caused Labor some damage and Bill Shorten's unpopularity, the scribes later on said that that 5% deposit guarantee probably clinched the election. So it's always been a political weapon. They call it wealth creation. Don't start up a business, just buy a house and you become wealthy. But they haven't got the brains to realise that's robbing from the next generation. it's all very well saying you bought a house for $200,000 in the year 2000 and it's now 1.8 million. Oh, great. Well, there's a couple of problems. Your kids in their 20s and 30s can't afford to buy a house of that value. And you're not going to be able to do much with that so-called wealth because you're still needing a home to live in. So we've got the conundrum now when everyone is supposedly wealthy, but there's no liquidity. And the younger generation are basically wiped out.
Yeah. And of course, the whole story here is that when you have politics setting the agenda, you can then basically play the story up, and this sort of artificial wealth is, created, but it's not real. You know, it's only there in paper until you actually crystallize. And the other point I want to make, Roger, the other way to think about it, it's not so much that house prices have gone up; it's the value of our dollar has gone down dramatically.
Yeah.
So it's actually, that's the way to think about it. We've actually had a huge devaluation rather than actually wealth creation. It's horribly artificial. Now, there are a few people who've done quite well because they got out at the right time. But for many people, they haven't. And of course, now what we're seeing is because rates are going up, interest rates are rising, the borrowing power of people, even with the existing fairly flawed control systems, are actually now getting to the point where they're going to be borrowing about 20% less than they could 6 months ago. Yeah. Now, that's going to put significant downward pressure on house prices ahead. And we also know that we're already seeing, if you look at some of the indices, even in the more bullish indices are showing a fall, particularly at the top end of the market. So we're now in the situation where that artificial bubble that was created over a long period of time and particularly accelerated the last 2 or 3 years is now coming unglued. The question I've got then is how much time will pass before effectively the APRA, the RBA and the Treasurer all panic and think, oh, we got to actually stop them falling anymore because essentially it's going to completely kill the economy and kill the banks.
Yeah, well, there's another problem, Martin. When you look at the wholesale funds that banks raise from overseas, the time will come, and it won't be far away, when they will start to say, we will not roll over your five-year loans on the same terms because of all sorts of reasons. We're worried about the Australian economy. We're worried about security, et cetera, et cetera. So what do the banks do then? Many, many billions of dollars that they can't roll over. They can't then demand it. All of their customers with mortgages start selling their homes and paying out their loans. They can certainly do it with 5 and 3 year rollovers, which is the other danger, by the way. APRA never instructed banks to advise their pending or intending borrowers of mortgage finance that, look, every 3 or 5 years, we are reviewing the rates in accordance with what the market is charging. Now, it was all right when the market was going down, interest rates were dropping, and they dropped from 17% 25 years ago down to 2% now. But when it's the other way around, people get caught. And you're now coming across increases of 40% per month in mortgage payments. Now, no one was warned about that. So that is a glaring mistake by APRA. They did nothing. They're supposed to be the gatekeeper. In fact, they are the assistants to the banking industry. Pure and simple. Conflicts of interest. They take their instructions, Martin, from Treasury.
Yeah.
Or the treasurer, which is the government. So, this is it's out of control.
And it's worth just remembering, Roger, there's this Council of Financial Regulators, right, which is where RBA, who sort of leads it, APRA, ASIC, and the Treasury all sit around the table and basically discuss whatever they want to discuss. Now, people keep saying, well, the RBA is independent. Well, I just wonder, really? Well, look at what the Council of Regulator is and who's, you know, the fact they're all sitting around the table there. That they are sort of all very much thinking the same way and driving the agenda the same way.
Yes.
There's no checks and balances that I can see. And the interesting observation, of course, they're now reviewing the role of the RBA, but APRA's role is excluded from the review, which makes no sense at all.
Yeah, exactly. And remember when Haynes had his Royal Commission, no one looked at APRA or APRA wasn't looked at then. Do you recall that?
Absolutely. They sort of got away relatively scot-free. ASIC got hauled over the coals. And it's just worth recalling, of course, that those critical recommendations that came out of the Haynes Royal Commission, which actually exposed a lot of really, really important bad behaviour in the banks, they all got swept under the carpet. You know, there's almost no change. They're doing precisely what they were doing previously. People are still getting loans that they should never get, in the first place. They're still using ratios which are way below reality. And yet the Reserve Bank is able to say, well, of course, everybody's got plenty of buffers, so buffers is going to be fine. There's no issues at all. And then, of course, even the banks, if you look at their reporting, will say about 40% of their customers have no buffers at all. So it's not like the buffers are equally spread across all households. We've got a lot of pressure under a lot of households, and it's going to get considerably worse. But look, there's no accountability anywhere that I can see in the whole of this edifice that we've created over the last 20 or 30 years. Everybody's pointing to somebody else. It's their problem, not my problem.
Well, exactly. And who was it recently? Oh, it was Buffalo, Mr. Lowe, who said it was within the last 8 or 9 months, he said, when he was clashing with APRA, he said, we do not have anything to do with controlling house prices. That's what he effectively said, which is rubbish, because if you are loose in your lending criteria, then prices go up, and they go up beyond where they should be. So therefore, the RBA is responsible, and so is APRA. But do you recall in about the third last day of the Royal Commission, Haynes himself was scathing. He said something along the lines of, I am mesmerised by the fact that neither APRA or ASIC accepts responsibility for quite a large area of the banking industry. And they both admitted that the next day, I think it was. There's this vacuum where neither of them are responsible. So how good is that after 20 years? 24?
I think that was by design. I actually think that this isn't just an accident. I actually think that the structural separation and the ability to be able to say it's somebody else's responsibility was actually created. There's a neoliberal sort of philosophy that says, let the markets be the markets, you know, don't intervene too much. You know, if people get into difficulty, that's their problem. It's not our problem sort of thing. I think this is all by design, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, who's going to solve it then? Let's accept that, yes, they're allowed to say, not my area, see you later, nothing to see here. Who is going to solve the problem? And the problem is people going bankrupt with loans that were given for grossly overvalued houses or overpriced houses. Who's going to pick up the tab or responsibility for that? It's as you said at the outset, it's a combination of the three. It's the RBA, it's Treasury, it's APRA, it's ASIC. The banks have just said, well, we're doing what we're allowed to do.
Well,
banks, making a lot of money. The most profitable banks on the planet in terms of, their turnover, etc. Way ahead. Look at the Commonwealth Bank shares in 1993. They were $5, something like that. They're now 102. That is 20 times up. Why would that be? Well, prior to 1998, banks as an investment were very poor. They might go up 3 or 4% per annum in capital value, nothing more than that, because they were lending money from depositors' funds, savings funds. They weren't borrowing wholesale funds from overseas. So when it took off like a rocket, so did their profits. And the other thing, Martin, is that the government has got themselves in a bind over is that superannuation, which is such a big thing, has a dependency on the share price of banks. Banks constitute 40% of the ASX market capitalization, which is huge. And all superannuation funds are heavily invested in the big four banks. So here you have the government saying, well, you know, if bank shares become properly priced because their profits are not so large that they've got to lend responsibly, which is the magic word, responsible lending, then they're going to find that the values of superannuation funds drop and you'll get consternation out in the voting public. And the government doesn't want that. So in the end, there is no difference between the LNP and the ALP in relation to what to do here. So that's interesting.
Well, yes, I suspect that the levers of higher migration and, you know, ultimately finding ways to give relief to people of their mortgages, you know, maybe like they did through COVID, those sorts of things will have to be on the table, because the question is, can they afford to allow this 40% correction, which I agree with you, long term is what actually we've got to get to. If we're going to get back to sensible levels, that's where you have to get to. The political cost of doing that, of course, would be remarkable. But it is worth underscoring, this was an accident created by design through 20 to 25 years of bad policy across multiple entities, across multiple governments, across multiple parties, and absolutely. You know, none of the major bank economists, none of the other independent economists really wanted to call this out, because they were actually chasing growth. And so it's been growth at all costs, and now we're reaping the consequences. And, you know, Roger, you've got the view is that interest rates will go higher, that property prices will correct, and the banks are going to be under huge pressure now.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that people are disregarding is that the generation, in fact, coming up to two generations soon, of people under the age of 40 have been disenfranchised. They are no longer part of normal society in this country. They have been excluded. They are subsidising the boomers, the baby boomers, those with seven houses, etc. Now, this is wrong. It's immoral. And there's going to be a backlash. There's going to be a backlash. If I was 22 years of age, and when I was 22 years of age, things were different. And they were talking about national service, for example, because possible wars in the Pacific, etc. As a 22-year-old right now, I'd be saying, get stuffed. I'm fighting for no one, government. You've dropped me in it. You've done nothing for me. You've disenfranchised me from ever owning a home. So that's it. Now, that might sound a bit dramatic, but there's anger out there, and it's justified anger. And the government is responsible for this. And so are the agencies, the so-called regulators who let the party go on. You know, don't take away the punch bowl. Let's have another party. It's a scandal.
And let's just talk about accountabilities, right? Because the other point about the scandal is that there is nobody actually standing up and taking accountability. The legal frameworks that exist in Australia are actually designed to protect those entities rather than actually make them accountable. And even somebody like Phil Lowe, who last November said rates aren't going to go up and then changed his tune, people are just saying, well, he's changed his tune. Where is the accountability in all of this? That's the thing that I'm struggling with, and it's a cultural thing that I see in Australia, I guess. And you and I are both Brits, right? So, you know, maybe that's part of the problem. But isn't accountability meant to be part of what you do when you're actually in public service?
Yeah, of course. You know, the other one, and you're right, we're both Brits, so we're in danger. The one I love is when governments are caught out or politicians are caught out, they'll always say, well, looking back, it's easy, to see these things. But at the time, we thought it was a thing to do. Well, why don't they say, at the time, we stuffed up. We made the wrong decision. We were incompetent. They don't say that. They say, it's easy to look backwards and see what you should have done. No one ever says, we made the wrong decision. Now, Lowe made the wrong decision when he said, because of COVID 2 years ago, we need to have the cash rate at 0.01%. Yep. He was making the case that business needed support, etc., and we need to enable the banks to have more liquidity, more lending capacity. Well, 82% of all the money went into bloody mortgages, straight into houses. Yep. Bang, up 28%. People buying their seventh home, etc. What a catastrophe. What a catastrophe. Lowe should have been saying, well, he should have been sacked anyway. He should have been saying, I was totally wrong. Totally wrong. I should never have reduced the rates to that figure. It was petrol on the fire.
Absolutely. Well, of course, central banks around the world all followed each other. They were all singing from the same hymn sheet. They all raced to the bottom with terms of interest rates. They all did quantitative easing. So part of the other problem that I see is that decisions are taken in that international context. And of course, we mentioned the BIS. I mean, the BIS to me is part of the problem because, of course, they're all driven off the same philosophy, either directly or indirectly. And that's that's another factor. So very often the central bank here in Australia isn't as independent of what other what other banks around the world are doing. So they're sort of chasing the same. But again, no accountability.
They're all in lockstep. You've got the Bank of England, the Irish bank comes into it as well. But then you've got Canada, the US, Australia, and New Zealand. Call them the Anglosphere, if you like. They are all interconnected. And that's it. So when the Bank of England increases by at least 0.5% next month, it might be higher, some are saying 0.75, that immediately puts the RBA here on notice, and that's what happened. And of course, the Fed is dictating things entirely right now, and they're just taking off. So we'll see what happens.
So that's why you've got the view that rates will go higher, and I tend to agree. The question is, how high will they go, and at what point will they then turn turtle and say, oh, we're killing the economy or we're killing housing or whatever, right? But certainly these higher rates are having massive impacts on households financially. But the other final thing I sort of come to is this has social consequences too, doesn't it, right? So if you think about the intergenerational struggles between, you know, those younger versus older households, they think that's intrinsically unfair. But if you look at where mortgage stress is now high, that often translates into social problems as well, and, you know, rising crime and all of those things too. So the decisions that those guys took without the accountability has consequences for individuals, businesses, communities, and the broader economy and Australia. I mean, these are critical issues. Again, nobody wants to take accountability.
Yeah, yeah. it's all over to you, so to speak.
Exactly right. Well, Roger, look, I appreciate your time and your perspective. You know, you've been watching this for a long, long time, and you've seen some of these cycles in the past, as I have done. But I have never seen such incompetence on a massive scale. That is actually, well, frankly, it's been politically supported and economically supported by pretty much everybody, other than the few are saying, hang on a moment, this does not make sense. And unfortunately, now we're going to reap the whirlwind. I fear for the next 2 or 3 years, I think it's going to be really uncomfortable for many people. And you know, I wonder about financial stability and whether it will actually shake out. But hopefully people will learn that you can't just lend forever for housing, and housing prices don't always just go up, and banks just can't make all of their money from lending for mortgages. They should be actually supporting the broader economy and lending for real purposes, right? Well, maybe out of the back of that, that's the lesson that we can take away. But boy, what a journey.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, Martin. Yeah, I think the worst is going to happen. I do, seriously. Because it's like overinflating a tire. You get to the point where the extra air has to burst the tire. It just doesn't come out slowly and everybody's fine. It bursts. And if you've seen a tire burst on a truck, it kills people.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and if you talk to economists, they have to admit there has never been an example where housing has been able to be deflated gently, right? Mm. It just doesn't work like that, right? Just as rising prices are driven by bigger credit, when you tighten the credit, when you turn the credit off, prices fall, then that negative momentum falls. Consumer confidence is already low, and therefore that leads to explosionary failure, as it were. 40% in Ireland, 35% in US global financial crisis. That's what we're facing, I think.
Yep, absolutely. And in the meantime, when you put a comment on Twitter to that effect, that we may be facing doomsday, you get every sort of nutter that comes out at you because you know they've got 4 investment houses and they're going for a 5th one, that's all they're concerned about. They're not concerned about the stability of the country or the mental health of the younger generation who have been excluded from property ownership on a feasible basis.
Absolutely. And it's funny how politicians seem to have quite large portfolios of properties, investment properties. So maybe they have vested interests too. So they've vested interests everywhere, aren't they?
Called a conflict.
Exactly. Roger, thanks very much for your time today. Really appreciate it. As always, you make very, very important points, and we'll spread the message far and wide.
Okay. And by the way, can you see in the top corner my bird hanging there?
Yes, I can. Yes.
It's been listening into you.
Very good.
Well, let's put it this way. I'll ask him afterwards. What are you going to tell Mr. Lowe? He'll have some advice, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I fear that the next little while is going to be pretty uncertain. But maybe if we can get some fundamentally changed thinking in the political sphere and in the economic sphere, we can actually learn from this. Actually, 25-year experiment in inflating to billio, and when it pops, it's going to be painful.
Just remember that truck tire with that extra bit of air pumped in, you know, to just make it a little bit better, boom.
Yeah, I was thinking of Mr. Creosote in Monty Python. Just one more way. Thank you, Roger. Take care.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye.